So we've talked about lots of things in our Adventures in Missing the Point series, and I thought we'd wrap up by talking about money. And the first time when you mention the word money in a room full of people, there's an automatic, like, the sweat level in the room goes up an extra 10%, because we all get a little weird when we talk about money, and we start thinking about, like, gold-plated chairs on religious broadcasting, and all they want is your money. But we've passed the bowls, and we will not pass them again today. So this is not like a push for, hey, hey, give, give, give. This is something that for our family has become a real conversation for us, because what we're realizing is that money is far more about our hearts than it even is our stuff. And so we have to talk about what is at the core of the way we as a culture, and a culture is made up of people. So what's at the core of the way we our posture toward our stuff? What's at the core of I think a lot of us would agree that we live in a greedy society, and what makes it that? Well, people make it that. And last time I checked, that includes me and you. So I want to spend some time looking through some words of Jesus and maybe asking where we see ourselves in this story, and what challenge we hear Jesus giving us in this story. And it's going to be in Luke chapter 12 if you have a Bible and you want to follow along. There we go. So Jesus is teaching, and someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, in the first century world of Jesus, this would have been governed by the Old Testament laws of inheritance. And so in this world, if a father had more than one son, the oldest son, the elder brother, would get two-thirds of the father's property. And so if a father passed and he owned like three fields, then the older brother would get two of those and the younger brother would get one. And if there was more than one younger brother, they would disperse that third between them. And so at this point, if this guy is asking Jesus to tell his brother to do this, this is most likely a younger brother, correct? Because the older brother does the dividing. And so he's like, "Hey, Jesus, tell my brother." So it's not even a question like, how much should I get? He already knows. He's made up his mind, and he wants Jesus to help him out. This is what gets called a Jesus juke. How many of you ever heard of a Jesus juke? It's when you're in a conversation and you take the intellectual level of the conversation down to zero by just saying something about Jesus. Like, you're having a conversation, somebody's wrestling with something, and you just go, "Well, I just believe in Jesus." And it doesn't really address the problem. This is what this guy's doing. He's saying, "Hey, I'm just going to bring in Jesus." He has all kinds of street cred. And if Jesus is on my side, then I win. Notice what Jesus does. He replies, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" He says, "That's not my job. That's not what I do. I'm not going to get involved in a family dispute. There's other people who do that." But then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." So at the surface level, this is a conversation about who gets what when a father passes away. But Jesus, and he does this all the time in the Gospels, he takes the conversation from kind of the surface level, and he tries to bring it down to what's really going on in the story. And for Jesus in this story, the real problem isn't who gets what in an inheritance squabble. For Jesus, the real problem is that this guy is struggling with something that Jesus sees as probably prevalent in all of the world, and that is greed. He takes it from just a dispute about property, and he says, "Watch out. Be on your guard." Do you get that language? That's a warning language. Watch out. Keep your guard up against all kinds of greed. Which leads me to believe that Jesus has insight into this that maybe we miss. And that would be that we think people wake up one day and decide to be greedy, right? I mean, we just wake up you know what? It's Tuesday. It's 9 a.m. The coffee's good. I'm just going to be a greedy person for the rest of my life. I'm just going to really put way too much attention and focus on my stuff, and I'm going to keep everybody else at a distance, and I'm just going to get more and more and more, and I'm going to live in the lap of luxury while everybody else starves to death. And then I'm going to go to lunch. I mean, like we don't do it that way, right? Greed is subtle. Greed slips in unnoticed, and the affection for things begins to grow. And before you know it, your heart is hard, and you become more and more focused on stuff and more and consumption and getting and getting. And getting. And Jesus says, you got to be careful. Be on your guard. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. And I think everybody in the audience probably said what we were thinking. Amen, brother. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. We get that. Right? We get that. Yeah, but if you look at how we live our lives, do we get that? I mean, there's a difference in affirming an idea and then really getting at the deepest level of who you are, what that idea is about. And when Jesus says life does not consist in possessions, there's actually some interesting wordplay going on there. There are essentially two words that often were used to refer to life in the Greek language, which is what the New Testament was written in. One was bios, and the word bios is like physical life, biology. Bios is what makes your heart pump. Bios is what makes the blood run through your veins. Bios is breathing, it's respiration. And bios is all the stuff that sustains life. So food is bios. A house is bios. It's all the stuff that makes life sustainable and comfortable and good. It's physicality. Jesus doesn't use this word. He doesn't say bios isn't made up of possessions, because bios often is made up of possessions. Bios is about our house. It's about our car. It's about the things that bring us comfort. But Jesus uses this word zoe. Now, zoe means full, abundant, vital life. When Jesus says in the Gospel of John, they'll have life to the full, this is the kind of life he's talking about. It's the kind of life that transcends just breathing. It's the kind of life that transcends just getting up and going through the routine. It's a real, full, joyous, peaceful, hopeful, vibrant sort of life. It's what Jesus would say is it's real life. And Jesus' point here is that you can have all the bios in the world and not have zoe. You can have all the stuff that you've ever dreamed of having, and the stuff you dreamed of getting after you got the stuff you originally dreamed of having. You can have all that stuff, and you can still be miserable, and you can still be lonely, and you can still not be living, really, really living. How many of you have ever known somebody, and you looked at that person, and you said, they're alive, they've got bios, but they do not have zoe? I had a great grandmother who was rich, really wealthy. I mean, she had CDs and bank accounts, and when she passed away, we found $10,000 in her freezer. That was her rainy day fund. I don't know what she does in the rain, but she's just absolutely wealthy beyond what, at the time I was probably, 20 years old, and I had like $7 in my bank account. So like when I was like, oh my goodness, she is so wealthy. And yet at the same time, she was miserable. She kept everybody at a distance. She would argue over a penny. Like she would want you to drive 20 minutes back to the grocery store to squabble over one penny. And she was miserable. She kept everybody at a distance because she thought everybody wanted her stuff. She had all kinds of bios, but at the end of the day, she didn't have zoe, not the kind of zoe we're created to have, not this kind of full, vibrant, joyous, abundant kind of life. And Jesus warns, when your life becomes wrapped up in stuff, you will begin to believe that that stuff is life. And really, you could lose all that stuff and still have zoe. Paul, at one point, he's writing about his sufferings, one of the early Christian leaders and writers. He's writing about how he's been beaten up, and he's been left for dead, and he's been shipwrecked, and he's been falsely accused. And it's this litany of suffering he's been through. And at one point, he says, we have nothing. We have zilch, zip, nada. We got nothing. And then his very next phrase is, yet we possess everything. I mean, I think we would all, in some intuitive sense, know that there's possessing something, owning something, and then there's life, which transcends all that. And you can have, we've all met people who maybe have nothing in the realm of bios, but they've got life that we can only dream of. It's a quality of life, not a quantity of possession. And Jesus begins with this stark warning. Don't let your guard down, because you'll begin to believe that bios can give you zoe, and it just doesn't happen that way. And then Jesus does something he often did. He moves on to tell a story. He tells a parable. Now, parables aren't literal, which means Jesus is not necessarily talking about a rich man in a community somewhere. Jesus is telling a story to try to illustrate a larger truth. And so this story, while it's not literally factually true, this story is true. Does that make sense? Like, it's true in a deeper sense. Jesus is talking about like human nature and how we're wired. He tells him a parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. Now, I've been preaching, teaching, doing my thing for about 15, 16 years, and I've probably preached about this story like 12 times or more. And when I read this story for this teaching, it was like I was reading it for the first time, which is kind of neat when that happens. Because there's a detail that jumped out to me that had never jumped out to me before. And you've probably seen it time and time again, but I've missed it. And here's the detail. This guy, before we know anything else about him, before we find out about the big harvest he had, and we're going to read about that, this guy was already rich. This isn't that situation where he was down at the like minute mark getting a lottery ticket the night before. When this guy, when he had the good harvest, he was already loaded. He was already set. Jesus already says, there is a rich man, and he owns a field, and his field produced an abundant harvest. Now, what tells you he's rich? In Jesus' day, most people lived and farmed family land. They believed it had been given to them by God, dispersed through Joshua and Caleb and those folks back in the Old Testament. And so they believed their right to this land went way, 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 way back. But what began to happen in Jesus' day, and we'll get a bit more into this, what began to happen in Jesus' day and before is poverty was at such a high level that people would get into debt. And when they went into debt and couldn't pay their debts, they would have to put their land up as collateral. And when they didn't pay, the land would be taken away. And so often you would have somebody who grew up and their granddaddy and their great, 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 great granddaddy all the way back to Joshua had farmed this piece of land. And now they're still farming it, but they're farming it for somebody else. They're not eating the harvest. They're working for a day wage, and somebody else is controlling their family land and what's going on. This guy, he's got his land. He's not working for anybody. He is his own boss. He's his own CEO. He owns the land. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Which brings up the age-old truth, mo money, mo problems, right? I mean, this is mo money, mo, never mind. This brings up the age-old problem. What do you do when your crops do really, really? What do you do when you find that winning lottery ticket? What do you do when everything you've ever worked for, what do you do when payday comes? And now you're trying to figure out, I've got more than I need. What am I going to do with this? Now, we hear this question in our culture and through our cultural lens, which is very different from Jesus. When we hear this question, we think this is a valid question. What is he going to do with his money? He needs to get a financial planner. He needs to sit down. He needs to talk about CDs and QVCs or whatever the stuff you rich people do with their money. You need to figure out where all this should go so it works and makes more money. And so he's set for life. He says, what am I going to do? This is a valid question. How many of you have ever sat down and had the conversation with a friend or your spouse or, you know, somebody, a coworker, like, if I won the lottery, here's what I'd do. How many of you have done this? You done this? And you just want to be prepared, right? There's something good about prep. Like, if we actually win this time, what are we going to do? And we always start with, you know, I'd give some to charity, then I'd buy a yacht. Right? When we have kind of our master, like if we strike it rich, these are the things we're going to do. What am I going to do? When we hear that in our culture, that's a question that makes total sense. It's a legit question. It has value to it. Like, we need to figure out what we're going to do with all this stuff. In Jesus' world, this question would have had a totally different sound to it. Marcus Borg, the central question, he asks, what shall I do? Now, Marcus Borg, in one of his books on Jesus, he does a brilliant job of taking us into the first century and describing what economics were like. For us, we live in a society that sees economics very differently. He says, we commonly think of at least three classes, upper, middle, and lower, and of the middle class as the largest class. How many of that makes sense to you? Now, you can argue about whether or not the middle class is shrinking, but how many of that three-tiered economic makes sense? You have an upper class? You have a lower class. Those are relatively smallish. And in the middle, you have this chunk of most of the people in our country. That's just kind of how we see it. There's the middle, and then there's, you know, the upper and lower. But in that world, in the first century world of Jesus, there was no middle class in our sense of a bulge in the middle. Rather, there was a very small class at the very top, no significant middle, and the vast majority, around 90%, are at the bottom. So right away, we have to flip our worldview on it. There is no, this is not, you know, an upper middle class guy who had a good payday. This is, you have a very small percentage at the top and the vast majority of people at the bottom. The lifestyle of the wealthiest 1% to 2% was extravagant. Their consumption conspicuous. They dwelt in palaces and villas, financed impressive public buildings, constructed fortresses, and maintained armies. Attached to them was a subclass that served them, known as retainers, commonly about 5% of the population. This would include government, religious officials, military officers, bureaucrats, managers, stewards, scribes, servants, and urban merchants who sold to them. So at the top, you have 1% to 2% of the people who are just filthy, stinking rich. And there's this other 5% who are doing better because they're attached to these folks who are really, really, really wealthy. And the rest of the population, that's roughly 7%. So 90, 93% of the population lives in poverty. He goes on to describe that. The most common shorthand name for the lower class in this type of society, about 90% of the population, is the peasant class. It consisted mostly of agricultural workers. Some owned small parcels of land, and others were tenant farmers, sharecroppers, or day laborers. It also included other manual workers, such as fishermen. Who were some of Jesus' earliest disciples? Where did he find them? What were they doing? fishing. Where does Jesus go to call his disciples? He goes to the peasant class. Why? Construction workers, artisans, miners. Jesus' father, it tells us in the Gospels, was named Joseph, and he was a what? Carpenter, which most likely meant working with stone, like a stonemason in that era. He was a carpenter. He was a construction worker. He was an artisan. So Jesus is from which class? The peasant class. Jesus comes from poverty, and his disciples come from poverty, because this is the world for most of the people who live in Jesus' world. And lower king servants. At the very bottom were the radically marginalized, the homeless, beggars, the lame, blind, the unclean, and untouchable. So, when Jesus tells this story, now you have to understand, Jesus didn't just tell these parables one time. He would have told them again and again as conversation brought them up, and in different settings as people would ask questions. He would tell these parables again. What we have in the Gospels are kind of, this is what his disciples remember. This is kind of the rough outline. So the story maybe was elaborated more at times, and maybe it contained, you know, he would change his voice inflection different times for different reasons. But what most scholars believe is that when Jesus would tell these stories, most audiences weren't polite like you guys. You know, you guys are just sitting there, like, paying attention, dozing off, doing your thing, not being rude. In Jesus' world, the audience would have been more vocal, and they would have been... So when Jesus has the rich man in this story ask, "What shall I do?" there was very likely, it wasn't rhetorical. There would be responses from the crowd. And so you can imagine somebody in the crowd would say, "You need to give some of that away. You need to give to the hungry people down the street. You need to give it away. You need to share. And you need to go plant more and grow more and give that away." I mean, so this was not just a rhetorical quiet, we're in, you know, it's Sunday, we're proper people. We're, you know, this was a real conversation where people are responding. And then you can imagine the gasps in the room or out in the field or wherever they were when Jesus told this story, because he says, he's speaking for the rich man. He says, "Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" I mean, how did the first audiences of Jesus, these early peasant crowds he's telling his stories to, do they like this guy? I mean, they're booing, they're hissing, they're throwing rotten tomatoes. They are ticked. Because this is, like, for us, it's a question, what should I do? For them, it's not a question. 90% of your neighbors are starving to death. It's a no-brainer what you do with your extra. What does this guy do? He realizes his current facilities are insufficient, so he tears them down. He builds new ones so he has a place to store his grain. It would look to me like he's living what we call the American dream. What is the American dream? You get a job, you do really well. You leave behind your smaller house and you get a what? Bigger house, and you leave behind the jalopy or the hoopty or whatever it is you used to drive in, and you get what? Nicer car. And you keep doing this. You keep upsizing. You keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger until finally you what? You retire and you're done. Just kick back, relax, sip a Mai Tai. I don't know what you do when you retire, but you just sit back and you're done. And you look at your life and you say, "Look, I've done so well. Done." I mean, this is the American dream. Bigger, better, let's quit early. This is it. Dude is living our dream. And when the first listeners of Jesus hear this, you can imagine they're going, "No way." Because Jesus doesn't criticize him for being rich, does he? He doesn't criticize the guy for having a good harvest. I mean, that's something I think Jesus would celebrate. "You had a good harvest? Yes. You doing well? Great. That's fine. That's beautiful." The question isn't, do you have a lot of money or do you have a lot of stuff? The real question is, what are you doing with it? The real thing is answering that question, what shall I do with what I've got? And I think we could talk about it. God says to him, so in this story, God interjects. So God's been kind of a third party watching. Then God interjects, "You fool." The word "fool" here, it means kind of like without sense, or my little boy's in here, and we don't let him say this word, but S-T-U-P-I-D, you with me? Like, it literally means like you don't have any sense at all. "You fool." Something else I noticed. When the story begins, Jesus calls him a what? A rich what? Man. But we all know this story is a story about a rich what? Fool. He starts out as a rich man, which means what? Jesus doesn't have a problem with him being a rich man. What he does with his wealth ends up, he's known to history as a fool. You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? You're done. Curtains. It's over. You're finished. And the question here is, what's going to be left? Somebody else is going to get your bigger barns. Somebody else is going to get your surplus grain. It'll probably be like two guys who are arguing over who gets what, just like the story began. You're done. Curtains. Then Jesus or Luke, whoever, this tag part says, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich toward God. And this is like, oh, so what God really wants is our money. God wants our stuff. And this is the point where we pass the bowls again, right? Because God wants your stuff. No. That's what's going on here. I think the rich fool has two sins that land him in hot water. One, he consumed everything he made. He assumed it was all for his consumption, all for his enjoyment, all for his blessing. Let me say this. I know people who I would consider rich who are some of the most generous, serving, compassionate people you will ever meet in your entire life. Rich does not equal this. Are you with me? You can be in the middle class, and maybe even the lower middle class or whatever, and you can have a really, really, really wrong view of stuff. You can have an attachment to stuff. It doesn't matter what your socioeconomic level is. So this is not a condemnation to rich people. I know we struggle as a family to not consume everything because it's what we want to do. It's our tendency. It's just more, 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 more. His sin is he consumed everything, and then two, he stopped making more. Like, he had a field that was producing and producing and producing. The right thing to do would be to keep growing food for people who are starving to death. The right thing to do is to not just step back and say, I'm not going to plant anything now, I'm done. The right thing to do is to keep producing so that more and more people can be blessed and more people can have food who wouldn't have had it before. There's this attachment he develops to his stuff. What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. He actually believes they're all his. He believes he had no help, and he believes he owes nothing. Bernard of Clairvaux, an earlier Christian father, said the extra food in your cabinet belongs to the poor. I'd argue this story, this is what this story is getting at. Is this really ours? To begin with, and attachment leads to consumption, because if it's yours, you can do whatever you want with it. If you have no accountability or no responsibility to anyone else, it's all yours. You can do whatever you want. You can consume it. You can build bigger barns. You can drive nicer houses. You can get that yacht you've always wanted. You can do whatever it is you've always wanted because it's yours. John Wesley, great Methodist founder, John Wesley. When he started out, he roughly made 30, I think it was pounds. It was a funny little British symbol that looked like a pound sign, so I'm just going to go with it. Let's say he made 30 pounds a year when he first started out. Wesley decided his first year, when he first started getting paid, he was going to live on 28, and he was going to give 2 away to whoever needed it, to the church, so that they could give to whoever needed it. And as Wesley, like happens to lots of us, his income grew over those first years. And so he started out at 30, and then he went to 60, and then he went to 90, and then he went to 120. And what's interesting about Wesley is his income grew. He kept a very similar pattern. He continually lived on 28, and he gave the rest away. He lives on 28. Like, no, I don't think he understands how this works. Like, you get more, you spend. That's just how it works. I mean, how many of you had this conversation at your house? Like, you remember those days? I can remember when we were first married, and we'd be just like digging through the couch that I had when I lived in college, which needed to be thoroughly fumigated before we could bring in the house. Like, we would dig through the couch for change to go to Sonic to get a milkshake. How do you remember those days? Like, when a milkshake was like, oh, we've got the money for a milkshake. We really can't tip, but we got the money for a milkshake. Like, in those days, you have these conversations. Oh, if we could just make what? Just a little bit more so that we weren't so, like, week to week. And then you get the pay raises and you get the jobs and things move in the right direction. And then you find yourself with lots of stuff and lots more money, and yet at the same time, you're almost spending more than you make, and so you have a very similar conversation. Like, if we could just get to this level, if we could just make a little bit more, then everything would be fine. And then you make that little bit more, and then what happens? You're still needing more, 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 because you have to keep up. You have to have the nicer, the bigger, the better. And maybe we're more like this rich fool than we like to give ourselves credit for. Now, I think there's a difference in guilt and conviction to do something different. I don't think you need to feel guilty. I don't believe in guilt. I don't believe in marketing and trading in guilt. Like, guilt is when you are watching TV and that Sarah McLachlan commercial about the abused dogs comes on, and you're like watching it and you're crying, and then it goes off and you're like watching a mindless comedy and you forget that it even came on. That's guilt. Guilt's like, I felt bad about that for about 20 seconds, but now they made me laugh. That's guilt. Guilt doesn't change things. Conviction, realizing that we've been greatly blessed, that we, like this rich man, if you were born in the West, if you were born in America, you have won the lottery. Congratulations. You win. You win. I win. We hit the jackpot. We've done it. Now, what are we going to do with it? That's the question. It's not a question of guilt. It's not a question of, should I ever take a vacation, or should I go out on a date with my spouse and enjoy a good dinner? And those are fine in their place and in moderation. They're fine. But the question becomes, am I consuming everything I make, or am I doing something that actually matters? Donald Miller, in one of his books, I think it's called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years or something like that, he talks about this. He says, if you watched a movie about a guy who wanted a Volvo and worked for years to get it, you wouldn't cry at the end when he drove off the lot testing the windshield wipers. You wouldn't tell your friends you saw a beautiful movie or go home and put on a record to think about what the story you'd seen. The truth is, you wouldn't remember that movie a week later, except you'd feel robbed and want your money back. Nobody cries at the end of a movie about a guy who wants a Volvo, but we spend years actually living those stories and expect our lives to feel meaningful. Truth is, if what we choose to do with our lives won't make a story meaningful, it won't make a life meaningful either. I think that's the greatest fear, though, isn't it? We fear meaninglessness. We fear that when we leave this world, nothing lasting or permanent or important will outlast us. We're afraid that our life's significance, it's going to die with us. And the reason we feel that way, I think, by and large, is because many of us, this guy right here, first and foremost included, many of us are living lives that if we would not pay to see that on screen. Like, it's just not, I mean, it's a story of consumption. It's a story of more. It's a story of bigger, better, shinier, and newer. It's a story of bigger dreams, bigger successes. There's nothing wrong with success. There's nothing wrong with dreams. They're beautiful. But are we actually living in a sort of way, a life that is going to outlive us? And Walter mentioned, like, there are no guarantees about how long this ride's going to last for us. Is there going to be anything left behind? Because Jesus says to this rich man, other people are going to get your stuff, which to me has this implication, and there'll be nothing left of you. Once they get your stuff, your story's finished. Yeah, I think we've all been shaped by people who are no longer with us, but they are still with us. They are with us in ways that transcend them physically being present. They're with us. They are built in to our DNA. They're built in to who we've become because they have shaped us and challenged us and helped us become better people. Essentially, I get to choose which life and which story I want to live in. I can live the story of the Volvo. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Like, we can live that story. Or we can live a story, as the prophet Isaiah says at one point, God speaking through him. People are like, what do you want us to do? And he says, spend yourselves on behalf of the poor. And then you'll experience, your salvation will break like the dawn. I think the reason this story of the rich fool is so powerful is because this isn't just a story about somebody else. This is a story about you and me and the fact that we have won the lottery. And we get to choose. And this story ends pretty harshly. I mean, if you read all of Jesus' parables, I never see a parable that Jesus tells where there's this quick of a, it's like God just immediately interrupts the story and says, dude, you're done. He did something so wrong, so evil, so vile, so heinous that he did not deserve to draw breath any longer. And what was it? Did he not believe in God? I don't think that's what it was. I mean, Jesus is a Jewish guy in a Jewish world telling stories about Jewish people. This guy was Jewish. He probably had lots of great beliefs about God. He probably believed in God more than we believe in God. It wasn't that his beliefs weren't in order. What prompts this action? You have more than you need, and you're building bigger barns instead of sharing it with somebody else. I mean, what do we do when we have, like, we get a bigger house? Have you done this? You move to a bigger house. This happened to us when we moved. We'd been married 4 years, and we moved, and our house was bigger. And we realized we still don't have room for all of our stuff. We have to get a storage unit. You ever done this? Like, oh, we have to get a storage unit. And so we're paying somebody like $100 a month to store the extra stuff we can't use right now. We're not doing that anymore. But we do that, right? This is why we have storage units. And we can live that story. We're free to live that story. We're free to live a better story. Jesus talks about this in Matthew 25. He tells a parable about a king who is separating people as a shepherd separates sheep and goats. And the sheep are on the right side and the goats are on the left side. And the king says to the sheep on the right side, welcome. Enter in to the party. Because when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was sick, you brought me a bowl of chicken noodle soup for the soul. When I was down and out, you were there. And they respond to the king. The righteous answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or feed you or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, which is like everybody, like this is God's way of referring to every other human being. And how does he refer to it? There's brothers and sisters. This is Jesus' way of saying all God's children are brothers and sisters. Whatever they did for the least of these brothers and sisters, they did for me. And then there's another group, the group on the left. The king says to them, depart from me, because when I was thirsty, you did not give me something to drink. When I was hungry, you didn't give me anything to eat. When I was in prison, you didn't visit me. When I was sick, there was no chicken noodles. Like you totally left me high and dry. And they respond, Lord, when did we see you? And because I think you would agree, if you saw Jesus hungry, how many of you would feed Jesus if you saw him hungry? Like if Jesus was holding a sign that said, we'll work for food, how many of you would give Jesus some food? I mean, how many of you would roll to you and go, get a job, and just drive off from Jesus? But you don't yell that to Jesus. And what's stunning about this is Jesus insists here, whatever you did not do for the least, the lowest, and the last, you did not do for me. Apparently, when you look into the eyes of need and of hurt and people needing compassion, people needing the basic necessities of when you look into their eyes, you're not looking into their eyes alone. Yes, they're a beautiful image-bearing creation of God, but when you look into their eyes, you're ultimately looking into the eyes of Jesus. I believed I cared about the poor, and then we went on this trip to the Dominican, and I was around poor people. People who, their kids are playing in sewage. They're drinking water we can't even wash our hands in. And I realized, I love the idea of caring for the poor, but caring for the poor is hard. You can't maintain a lifestyle and care for the poor. Something has to give. I think when Jesus tells this story, what he's saying to us is something has got to give. I think these stories are meant to spark conversation. And the thing I came away from this story asking was, is it possible that I'm a bit more like the rich fool than I'd like to think? Can I just give you a confession? When I read Jesus' stories, I'm always the good guy. I'm like always right there with Jesus going, you tell him, Jesus. You know, I'm always with Jesus. I'm always the good guy in the story. When Jesus tells a story about somebody who's generous, guess which guy I am in the story? I'm a generous guy. Jesus. I'm always like Jesus. We're always the good guys in the stories we tell, aren't we? I mean, we just are. We love being the good guy. And so I'm the good guy in the story. And what I began to realize is I really read Jesus' stories, and as I really take them more and more seriously, I'm actually never the good guy in Jesus' story. I am the older brother who is ticked off that the father would throw a party for a son who'd gone and blown half his money. I'm the guy who wants to be stingy and treat other people and hold other people to the fire when I've been given such grace, when I owed great debt, and yet I don't want to forgive the smallest debt people owe me. I'm the guy who doesn't forgive. What I find again and again in these stories, I am not the sheep on the one side going, yep, party in heaven. You know, that's not me. I'm the goat going, yeah, you're right, Jesus. I've passed you time and time again, but I was on my way to bigger, better, more, and I totally didn't see you in those people because they've always been those people. And I wonder how many of us, if we're really honest and we like strip away all the varnish and all the religious bull that we put up front of us, like how many of us would just say, like, I'm probably a lot more like the rich guy. I mean, if people ask me if I'm rich, you know, compared to Western standards, I would say no. No, we're middle class. But we're rich. We have won the lottery, brothers and sisters. The real question is, what are we doing with it? Are we more like this rich fool tearing down perfectly fine barns to build bigger ones? Or are we, as Jesus insists his disciples will be, are we people who look in the places devoid of hope and life and nourishment and enough? And are we going to those places and saying, no, it is unacceptable that you do not have enough and we have more than we need. We're going to do something about it. And that doesn't matter if it's down the street from you or if it's in the DR or if it's somewhere else. This is the call. This is who we're called to be. I just wonder, are we more like this guy? Sitting back, looking for a way to take it easy, counting our money. The world's dying. What do you do with this? Besides not have a good lunch because you're totally depressed now. I think if this is about guilt, it misses the point. I think it involves really difficult conversations about your family, and we have been having these as a family. Like, well, how are we going to organize our lives differently so that we can be more like John Wesley and less like the rich fool? How can we be more like, if we were to get handed the lottery tomorrow, we'll live on what we have now and we'll give. Like, how can we become those kinds of people? And I think it begins with conversations. I think it begins with, like, the first step is admitting that we have a problem. I think for many of us, for me, the first step is admitting, you know what? I care way more about me than I do other people. And I think it's like, I feel like I'm in like a meeting right now. Hi, my name's Josh, and I care more about myself than I do any of you. Like, but I think that's true of so many of us. And it's learning to shift that focus off of us and have honest conversations with our families and with our kids and talk about what can we do differently so that yes, we can live and we can enjoy our lives and we can have enough food to eat and maybe we can go to a movie sometime and that'd be great. And, you know, but on top of all, how can we live the kinds of lives that outlive us? The good stories, the ones that you pay to see, the ones that you want to live through are the ones where people transcend this, you know, everyday ordinary, and they transcend it and they do something so meaningful that it lasts. And that can't be fixed in a sermon. That can only be fixed and remedied and changed in real conversations between real families and real individuals who are tired of living in a story that's not good enough. And they want to live in a story that will totally outlast them. Does that make sense? Yes? All right, let's pray. God, first and foremost, I need this story. Because I admit that I am the rich fool. And I think if more of us really take the time to wrestle with this, I think maybe the majority of us would admit that in some ways we have been chasing a dream that may be American, but it's not yours. It's not kingdom. Maybe many of us are living in a story that we wouldn't pay to see on screen. God, we desperately want meaning and purpose. And too often we search in bios for that, and we're looking for Zoe. So call us away from the cheap, the imitation, the kind of life that can't measure up and can't sustain and can't fulfill. Call us to the kind of life that outlives us, transcends us, makes more of a difference than we could ever make on our own. God, I thank you for my brothers and sisters, and I thank you for the people I know in our community who have done really well for themselves and they continually give to others. I thank you for that challenge and that inspiration. Father, I thank you for those who continually serve. They're continually pouring themselves out so that others can benefit. I want to be more like them. Because so many of our brothers and sisters here give such a great example of your character and who you are through the way they give and serve and love. Help us to follow their lead. Maybe we be people of radical compassion, radical grace. May we have really difficult, painful conversations about how we're living so that we can live lives that outlive us. We love you. We thank you. We offer this in the strong, healing name of Jesus. Everybody said, amen.